Support for Gig with Mike Redman comes from Music Connection. For 45 years, connecting artists and musicians with each other and the industry. And you can find them on the web at musicconnection.com. Well, hey, everybody. Welcome to Gig. I'm your host, Mike Redman. Yep, that's me. And in today's episode, I'm happy to introduce you to mastering engineer Anna Frick. Mastering isn't just about making your song louder. It's about unlocking its full potential. The delicate balance of enhancing dynamics while preserving the artist's intended vibe. Well, Anna has this perfected to a delicate dance. You know, I've sat in the studio while some of the most iconic music has been mastered, and I have one huge takeaway. I just don't have the ear of a mastering engineer. Well, Anna has a finely tuned ear that helps her to be the kind of like the guiding light for musicians that want those crystal clear highs, punchy lows, and a balanced richness that draws people in. That's the magic of mastering. And Anna Frick is here today, which is awesome. So Anna, if you don't mind, we're just going to jump right into it. I know you're busy and I'm pretending to be. So would you start off by telling everybody what a mastering engineer does?
Mastering is that last creative step before an album or a record goes out to the general public. So it's that last step to make sure that everything is sitting well, that it's going to translate well onto any system you put it on, and making sure it's both impactful and, realizing the full vision of the artist and the producer. So it's that last chance to make sure it's got the hit that you intended.
Why did you choose mastering over being a recording engineer or a mix engineer or a re-recording engineer?
I came about it kind of accidentally. I was working various jobs, and then I got the opportunity to be an assistant engineer at a mastering studio. And, that just kind of put me, in the deep end of it. And I was quality checking all the masters and like learning from the mastering engineers there. And I realized that I was around, world-class engineers and world-class equipment. I should maybe do everything I could to learn every little aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of set to task to it, and I found that it suited me really, really well.
Cool. Is that a 16-track recorder I see in the back?
It is, yeah. Wow. Yeah, we're about to move it out of here because it just doesn't get used. But then we also have, our 102 there with the Aria electronic, which gets a lot more use.
So thanks for taking me way back. This is crazy. One of the biggest questions I've always had, and I really have no idea what the answer is personally. I have a friend that she is a winemaker in Sonoma, and she was trying to explain to me how she's trained her palate. And how does a mastering engineer, or maybe how did you go about training your ear to hear differently than maybe the artist or just everybody else?
Yeah, I mean, it started... when I was the assistant engineer and when I was quality checking everything, I was, very critically listening on headphones to everything and, questioning every little click and pop and distortion and that kind of thing. And so it was that kind of thing. And then, I would sit in the mastering rooms, kind of at night and when everyone else had gone home, and I learned the workflow, and I sat there and listen to every click of every knob on every piece of gear, just A being, mix, the flat mix to, that one little maneuver. And, I would try to do it without, trying to have any, understand what I was doing and just saying, can I hear it? And, just kind of train my ear like that. And then I, was comparing the mixes to the masters from, the engineers and seeing what they did, looking at their recall notes, asking them why they chose to do that. So it was just a lot of, very intentional listening and very intentional, you know, questioning of everything and looking at notes and getting really familiar with every piece of gear.
Do you have a knob that you turn in your brain that says, okay, this is bluegrass, this is folk, this is pop, you know what I mean? Like just the basic stuff that you see in Logic, and it'll, you know, pick different genres of music. Do you have a knob that you pick in there and say, okay, this has to have XXX?
Yeah, I mean, you know, understanding the different nuances of the different genres, like what the listeners are listening, you know, I approach it from being a fan, you know, like yeah. I'm a fan okay. of so much music. And so it's, you know, when I'm driving down the road, listening in my car, I'm asking myself, why is this song, you know, why is it, what makes this song pop, or what makes this song Americana? And it's both the elements, but also the feel and the songwriting. And there's so many different elements. And so it's asking those questions of like, you know, what makes this one or the other? And then, you know, what do I need to be focusing on when I'm working on that genre? So, you know, rock, it's, you know, it's the guitars and the bass, and, you know, bluegrass, it's the tonality of the instruments and the articulation of every string, that kind of thing. So just understanding what the listeners are looking, you know, mm-hmm. looking for, and what draws people to that specific genre, and then just keeping that focused. So yeah, it's kind of like having the knob in the brain for sure. Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty crazy. So are you a musician too?
I would not call myself that. I came at this from just having an immense respect for musicians, because I didn't have any of the talent myself. So I just wanted to be in service of them. Like, how can I help them, you know, elevate their talent, elevate their skills, and facilitate, you know, success for them. And, you know, then I started hanging out at bluegrass festivals, and somebody put a mandolin in my hand, and I've learned about that much of that. I would not call I'm definitely not like a bluegrass picker. I strum it. I haven't made it past the third fret. I'm totally okay with that.
It's kind of fun just to strum it.
Yeah, it totally is. Like I recently acquired an octave mandolin, and that has been really fun. So
what is that? I'm a guitarist, etc.
Okay. Yeah, just an octave mandolin. It's just it's
just one octave.
Yeah, it's just one full octave down. Oh. So it's a little bit more among the realm of like a guitar. So it's fun to strum and cool. sing along with. And so I play along with my friends, you know, but yeah, there's nothing. I will never play around professional musicians because it intimidates the hell out of me. I have incredible stage fright. So,
That's fine though. You know, you make me think. It's very funny because when I was writing music for a living, and Dave and I were actually working together at that point, I didn't go out and listen to a lot of music or even listen to a lot of recorded albums and stuff because this, you know, I turned into this internal critique. Everything I listened to, I was critiquing it and tearing it apart in my head. And there was very little music that I could listen to that I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. Now that I'm not doing it anymore, I have a lot more fun listening to music. So how about you? When you're listening to the radio or you're listening to music, do you find yourself like tearing it apart?
I, try my hardest not to. I keep joking that, I'm going to get a hat made, you know, to wear to shows that just says off duty. Because I don't want to think about it. I'm there for the vibe. I'm there for the experience. And you know, I always want to keep that, you know, music lover, lens on things. And so it's yes. Sometimes I want to critique things. And if something is really egregious, that I will, but, for the most part, I want to be taken away. I want to be immersed in
that's
experience. And so I try to, you know, take the work hat off and, you know, put the music lover hat on, when I'm listening, and live music is really the space that I have held for myself as being sacred. And I will never, you know, go and talk to a front of house engineer and tell them their, you know, mix is bothering me. I will never do that.
Oh God, I thought
unless they ask for my opinion, you know, but other than that, like I'm there to experience the music. And so, yeah, I kind of keep live music as my sacred space.
Would you recall a project that was really challenging that when you were done with it, you were happy?
Oh my gosh, there's been so many. You know, I do these really large restoration projects that involve like a ton of assets and that kind of thing, and they're really rewarding in what they're trying to preserve, and there's no like glory involved in them, right? So it's not like they're going to be Grammy winning or anything like that necessarily. Sometimes, but I worked on this one project way back in the day that it was both emotionally challenging and both technically challenging because I was just learning the restoration space and the digitizing old reels. I was just learning that whole process, and there was this project that was it was these audio letters. They were like little like 3-inch reels. That this kid from, I think he was from Louisiana, he was mailing them home to his parents from Vietnam. He had been drafted to Vietnam. And so it was these letters, and he would be in the middle of recording it. And then, you would hear some shelling in the background, and he would turn off the recording, and then he'd come back, and say, oh yeah, sorry, I had to, head for the bunker, but I'm back now, couple of friends got hit by some shrapnel, but we're all good
now. Oh my God.
And then at the end of almost every reel, he would say, and mom, if you could just send me some pasta, I really miss your pasta.
Wow.
Like, at the end of one. So it was like this very humanizing aspect. And, he was talking about, he was an interrogator. So he would interrogate, suspected Viet Cong. And so just from an emotional level, I decided to go through it chronologically. And so it was this whole tale, over the course of like the year that of reels that he had sent home, really fascinating. And then also just the challenge of like these tiny little reels and getting everything set. And so, so that was a fun, but, really rewarding and also very challenging project.
Do you mind if we get technical for a little bit? Because some people that are going to listen to this are going to be people that, really want to know more, a little bit more. So I thought we'd dig in for a second. So what kind of tools do you use mastering that I, as a, a songwriter or something using Logic, might not even know about?
Meters. Meters are really important. Just knowing where you're at, having that frame of reference. Because a meter is different than a volume knob, right? I mean, I hate to say it, but mid-side processing is huge.
You explain what that is?
Yeah, it's kind of, instead of dealing with the stereo mix and, in terms of left and right, you're looking at the middle of the mix and then the sides of the mix. So on a most traditional mix, you want the vocals to be nice and centered, on a lot of genres have them standing out front. And sometimes when they're a little buried in the mix, you can, kind of bring them out a little bit more, in the mastering phase by, bringing out some frequencies on the, mid channel as opposed to the sides or dialing back those presence frequencies on the sides. So it creates this like triangularity to the mix, which gives a little bit more depth sometimes. That's a little, trick to keep in your back pocket. You've got to be very careful with it. Develop some phase issues pretty quickly, but, a tool that, I use quite frequently.
The funny thing is the education that you're kind of delivering here is just kind of all plays to the fact that they should be calling you. One thing that's really misunderstood that maybe you could just clear up is it's really important the order that you put your plugins in. Do you know what I mean? I mean, the compressor before EQ, before a limiter, et cetera. Is that something that I should be thinking about as an artist?
Yes and no. I mean, I think there's an aspect to getting too technical in the creation phase and having that kind of crush your creativity. I think, you know, there is, it was drilled into me in college that limitation brings, breeds creativity. So if you limit yourself to only having a few tools, you know, just EQ or something like that, then you can kind of shed away all that other stuff that's taking away from what your focus should be as an artist, which is, you know, creating. So, you know where the guardrails are, stay within those guardrails, you know, using, you know, some compression or whatever. It's just to, you know, keep your vocals from peaking and that kind of thing.
Yeah, but yeah.
Don't go so far as to being using those tools in the create in the destructive sense where it's inhibiting, you know, what you should be focusing on.
How do you see something like AI helping or potentially replacing your job?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a very scary aspect of mastering right now is this idea that you can do this automated mastering and AI mastering. And, you know, the way I look at it is like, you know, music is meant to, it's meant to move people, you know, it's meant to connect with your heart, in, you know, a very human way. And so when you're leaving, you know, that last creative step, that last chance to make something impactful, something that's going to connect to your listeners and draw them in on an emotional level. Mm-hmm. If you're leaving that to an algorithm, like you don't, there's something about it, you know, at least the way I approach mastering, there's something about having that human element of saying, this is not, I want this chorus to hit harder because it's, you know, I want people to listen to this. Like this is the big, you know, culmination of the song or whatever, to have that emotional, lens on everything. You can't necessarily build that into an algorithm or AI necessarily, maybe in the future. I don't know.
Anna, that's a wonderful answer. I mean, it's me as a composer, you know, if I'm getting to a chorus or exciting part, I may, you know, I change the tempo a beat or two and move it up. You know, and I orchestrate that way as well. So what we're saying kind of, right, what you're saying, I mean, to encapsulate is kind of like, why do you want to give the last step of your art to a computer to decide how it's going to be?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. That's cool. So with that in mind, what are some of the advantages, not just that piece of it, but what are some of the other advantages of having a professional master your music?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's that human element. It's that it's perspective, right? Like, you know, I tell my students, you know, I'm paid for my perspective, not necessarily for, you know, the gear that I'm using or anything. It's perspective and ears, you know? So, it's both having that, critical lens on your mixes, but also that fresh set of ears where, you know, when you're in a mix, you know, when you're mixing and when you're creating, it's you're concerned with every little aspect of it, and you can get kind of you know, singularly focused or a little too down the rabbit hole in that. So to have a mastering engineer kind of pull your perspective out and say, "Have you thought about this?" or "This isn't, you know, this doesn't seem to be matching your vision," or you know, you overthought this part or whatever it is, you know, just having that, you know, 3000 foot lens on something is really important. And then, you know, a mastering engineer also understands the marketplace. So it's not just like, is this technically where it should be? Is this artistically where it should be? But it's, how is this going to fit out in the real world? How is this going to translate? So it's a lot of different elements, but it's that perspective. So yeah, I get paid for perspective.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. You must have a very good perspective.
I try to.
If I was interested in having you master my music, and I'm mixing it, and I think this is something that most people don't understand at all, what are a couple of the things I should keep in mind when I'm mixing if I know I'm going to be sending it to you?
Oh my gosh. Check your mixes in mono. make sure they're mono compatible. Mm-hmm. Going back to the, you know, falling in love with a plugin or something, mm-hmm. I see a lot of mixes come in where they've just used a widener, you know, some kind of imager on it, and it just doesn't translate. There are so many applications out in the real world where it will collapse down to mono. And so if you're not checking your mixes in mono, mm-hmm. it becomes a problem, you know?
Yeah, okay.
So that's one. So, you know, pay attention to that. Mm-hmm. Look at the crest factor, you know, the dynamics, like, it drives me crazy when, I get up on a soapbox about,
that's okay.
You know, and when a mix engineer says, you know, well, what should the LUFS be for my mix, uh-huh. you know, when sending to you? And it's like, no, don't worry about that. I want it dynamic, you know, leave the loudness to me. Like that's my job. Is to make sure that, you know, your dynamics and your density or lack thereof in your mix translates when it gets loud enough. Mm-hmm. So don't worry about how loud it is. Worry about the balance of everything. Mm-hmm. You know, so give me some headroom, yes. But, you know, when we're talking about digital mixes, especially, like, you can have you know, a wide dynamic range. And it's not going to, you know, it's not going to destroy the mix. So aim for dynamics, aim for balance. Let me handle the loudness.
Don't let me, do you mean, in other words, lay off the adaptive compressor and squishing it and then limiting it and sending you something that's flat straight across and expect exactly. you to fix it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's, like, those are great.
Don't put that master bus compressor on there. It drives me crazy. Sometimes people will put it on the master bus compressor or a compressor on the master bus. And it'll be squashed all to hell and they'll fall in love with that sound. And then me doesn't have that on it. And then I'm chasing a ghost, you know? So usually if the artist has approved something that has, you know, that compressor on the master bus, I'm like, mm-hmm. well, give me what the artist approved and then give me, you know, the mix without that. And so I know what the artist is listening to.
Oh, that's interesting. That's a great way to do it. Yeah. So do you take, we're just got a couple more questions, but do you have to take breaks so that your ears don't fatigue to death?
Yeah. Sometimes I'll bring my dog into the studio so that she can, you know, remind me of, like, hey mom, you've been sitting there for a long time. I need a walk, or, like, uh-huh. you know, let's go play or whatever. So, but yeah, I have been better about taking breaks recently. I'm trying to get better in the practice of that. But yeah, I usually take at least a 5 minute break every hour or so.
That's good.
And you know, some, and then a longer break here and there. But yeah, usually I can kind of tell when I'm starting to add more things to a mix, uh-huh, like uh-huh. more plugins, more effects, uh-huh. like just the more I'm adding, the more I realize, like, oh, I need to take a break. And then I come back and, you know, take all that stuff off and kind of start from square one again and simplify things. So when things get too complicated, it's usually because my ears are fatigued.
So. You have your own company. Mm-hmm. And two things, how do you market your services? And then would you tell everybody how to find you?
Yeah. Marketing is something that I have come to the realization that it's not my forte. I hate mm-hmm. doing it. It doesn't feel genuine to me. But I'm lucky enough to have a lot of referrals. So it's a lot of word of mouth. Just being a member of my community, not being disconnected, being, you know, just genuinely interested in the music that my community is making. Mm-hmm. That has, you know, that has come to me, you know, as work, you know, so just being present and being with my people, mm-hmm. that is where a lot of my work comes from. So I don't necessarily do marketing per se. I'm uh-huh. terrible about sending out my email newsletter. I'm trying to be better about it, but it's
hard.
I hate it.
You're a creative person, and creative people are really, let's just say, shitty at marketing.
Yeah.
We really don't care about it. but we also know when the work stops and we're like, oh, and somebody says, oh, well, it's because you never market yourself. So how does everybody find you? What's the website?
So the name of my company is Ally Sound. So the website is allysound.com. It's allysound.com. And yeah, you can reach out to me there. Send an email through my website, and I'm a one person company, so I'll be the one responding to you. So,
well, thank you so much for spending some time with me.
Well, thank you so much. It's so wonderful to chat with you.
Theme music for Gig with Mike Redman was composed and produced by Other Animal. Thank you for joining me today for another episode of Gig with Mike Redman. If you like what you heard, I'd ask that you subscribe and like us. And finally, if you have questions about a job or ideas for an episode, contact me at gigwithmikeredman@gmail.com. Until next time, I'm Mike Redman, signing off.